Welcome once again to the Lime Leaf Podcast. I'm John. I'm here with the usual suspects. We have Blaine.
Hey, how you doing?
Bubs, how are you?
Good. How is everybody else doing?
Good. This week, we have guests. So the topic today is going to be why your tech startup should be a worker co-op. We'll get into what a worker co-op is, all those things in due time. But first, our guests, Steve Giordano from Interstitial. Morning, Steve.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
And Ethan Nguyen from Oberon. Ethan, nice to see you.
Yeah, great to be here.
All right. So why your tech startup should be a worker co-op. What motivated this episode was just, I think what I was starting to see was, you know, there's so many layoffs in tech now. There's all this consternation and angst about AI, and we're all going to lose our jobs, and software engineers aren't going to exist in 2 weeks, and all this kind of stuff. And it started me thinking about why. So just for context, Lime Leaf Worker Collective, which is mine, Blaine, Mubs, and Eric. Eric can't join us. He's working. That's our co-op. The main reason that I wanted to start it was just I had just had a bad experience in a tech company and decided to venture out on my own and thought, like, you know, equity, all these things, I want this to be a co-op. So that's why Lime Leaf's a co-op. And I think more tech companies should be co-ops, and we'll get into that. So I think that's, you know, timely as far as what is a co-op. So I just noticed the other day there's a really good episode of a podcast called Stuff You Should Know called How Worker Co-ops Work. So I would encourage people to go listen to that so that we can spend more time here on talking about the tech industry and all these things that we think pertain to co-ops. There, you know, just a few examples. There's big co-ops. There's one called Mondragon. Some companies that you might not be aware of are co-ops. So REI, which is a big outdoor sort of clothing and equipment company here in the United States. True Value Hardware is a co-op. There are other types like the dairy co-ops, like Mando Lakes is a not necessarily a worker co-op, but it is a co-op. So we're out there. You just, you know, a lot of people don't know. In our own space, you know, that in tech, there's one called Egalia, which is in Spain. Colab, there's groups like Cotech. There's a whole bunch of them, and I encourage people to do some research there. So there are precedents for tech companies being co-ops, and I think it's just going to keep growing. So before we jump into all that, I wanted to just give Steve and Ethan an opportunity to just tell us a little bit about, you know, your background, how you got into the co-op world, and, you know, tell us about the co-op that you work with now and what you guys do. So let's start with you, Ethan.
Sure. So my name is Ethan Nguyen, and currently I'm working as Director of Technology, and I'm also Chair of the Board at Oberon Cooperative. And at Oberon, we're a worker-owned conglomerate, which means that we bring companies into worker ownership through acquisitions. Our mission is to use the engines of business in service of humanity. And so that means using tools like capital stacks and, you know, leverage acquisitions to actually bring companies into a worker-owned large parent cooperative. And we also do some incubation. So we incubate some startups in technology and finance and other things. As far as my journey into cooperativism, there's two ways I could tell the story. One is I started out working in the kind of Web1 tech world, and then that was sort of a hired programmer for hire. And for a while, I got a little bit over that, and kind of the Web1 bust came. Decided I wanted to do something more aligned, and so I got into political tech, and that was when civic tech was emerging, and the kind of the real dream of how technology could make our political discourse and political engagement more powerful, which I guess in some ways was born out. and then, and you know, even there, it was still kind of in the kind of structure of partnerships, and the folks who had the most capital, the most connections, had the most control, and the rest of everyone else worked for them. And that, the friction between that and the values that brought me to that space really built up over time. And when I had the opportunity then to go into connecting with a then small technology cooperative, which was CoLab Cooperative, I had been on the board of my local food co-op and really kind of excited about it, and jumped in and haven't looked back since. That's about 15 years ago now. Mm-hmm. The other way that I've realized recently is I'm also a third generation worker democracy advocate. So my grandfather was a labor organizer who was really fought for workplace agency and democracy within his unions. And my father was also a historian of labor. And so I didn't realize until maybe about 3 or 4 years ago that I was just continuing the family business.
Cool. Yeah. Awesome. But Steve, how about you?
Yeah. So I'll give you a little bit of my background. So I got into tech probably about 15 years ago or so. Been working in a number of different tech companies. Like many of us, we don't stay at a tech company for more than a few years. I feel like if I've met someone who's been at a company for more than 5 years, that's unusual. And I've just always accepted that's part of the tech industry. You jump around, you move around, you stay someplace, you don't like it after a few years, and you move on. So I was at a bunch of some startup-y companies, some larger mid-sized companies. Then I started really thinking about labor organizing, unionizing. This was also around the time that tech workers started unionizing, around 2018, which is when I think we saw Kickstarter form the first tech worker union. So I was really, really interested in that, tried doing some organizing at my workplace, didn't really work out. But I was really frustrated, like most of us, with the undemocratic nature of not just tech companies, but companies in general, and seeing leadership make so many bad decisions that were bad for us, the workers. But if you actually look at it from their perspective, it was great decisions, because I've seen a lot of people walk away millionaires and a lot of workers walk away getting laid off. Just feeling really frustrated with the whole industry and the constant need for growth and acceleration and dominating the market and being the number one this in the world and the number one that in the world, when I just want to be able to feed myself and live in an apartment that I can afford. So then I got laid off about 2 or 3 years ago from a mid to large size tech company. And they offered a lot of help finding new work, but I just couldn't stomach going back into another traditional tech company. So I really, really struggled and really tried to figure out what I could do that would live up to my values. I stumbled across the idea of worker cooperatives, which somehow had not been forefront in my brain before that. And just the more I learned about worker cooperatives, the more I realized this is what I want. This is what every one of my frustrations at every company, this is what I wanted the company to be, and it never was. And so I just kind of went down that path. I took some online courses with the New School about worker cooperatives, learned more about the history, the radical nature of worker cooperatives, the practical nature of ones that exist and how they exist. And then I started doing freelance and contract to pay the bills with an eye towards forming a co-op or joining a co-op in some way. And then about a year ago, I was fortunate to see an open membership call for Interstitial Co-op. And so I applied there. And so I've been a member of Interstitial Co-op for about a year now. I can talk a little bit about the way we're structured, or I can hold off on that if better for another time.
Yeah. No.
Interstitial is structured, everyone is an independent contractor. So we all still are seeking out contracts, but we're working with each other to find contracts as well. So we're not the type of co-op where we have a product or a service that we sell and has regular income. And this is pretty common for tech co-ops. I think it's one of the easiest ways to get a tech co-op off the ground, to just collect a bunch of contractors together and pool your resources, hire a lawyer, have some shared common bylaws. We do some profit sharing. So some bit of every money you make goes back into the co-op to pay for keeping things going, and then everyone gets some money back at the end in terms of patronage. But it's very open and very flexible in terms of how involved you want to be, which is nice because it gives everybody a chance no matter where they're at. If they have a full-time job but they're trying to get involved with the co-op, they can join a co-op like Interstitial, and then when they're at a point where this is making them enough money, they can move over. Or if this is your only gig, you can put all of your time into it. But it's been really nice having other people to talk with, have ideas, kick around ideas. Yeah, that's kind of my background. Yeah,
that's a cool model. What we do at LimeLeaf is more, I mean, we're making some products, but we also do contracting stuff. So having that independent contours, people sort of float in and out as much or as little as they need or want to. That's pretty cool. Okay, so co-ops. If those of you are back from listening to this Stuff You Should Know episode, you now know all you need to know about the background of co-ops. But I think the two most important things for this conversation about co-ops are that workers own them and they are democratically managed. So those are two of the seven principles that most co-ops operate under. So in the ideal scenario, everybody who works at the co-op is an owner of it, and everybody gets one vote. So one member, one vote. You vote on, and it, again, in your charter for how you set the thing up, you can determine like, okay, these are the things that we're going to vote on. These are the things we're going to leave to a board of directors, whatever. But important stuff, the people who do the work get to vote on the direction of the co-op, what kind of strategy you want to do, all those sorts of things. And you have not only equity, there's been this also kind of movement lately of worker ownership in tech, where you have a lot of very rich people who go to a TED talk and say, we're giving all our employees stock options. I have strong opinions about that. I've had stock options. Let's be frank, I've done pretty well with stock options I've had from companies where I've worked, but that's not real worker ownership because you don't get a vote. In my opinion, you don't get a vote, you're not a co-op, or you're not even a worker-owned or whatever you want to call it business. So as all this pertains to tech, in tech there's essentially two types of not types of people, but like classes of people. There are founders and executives and board members and all that stuff. And then there are people that do the work. There are workers within tech companies that write the code, do the product design, all that stuff. Those two classes of people, in my experience, have very fundamentally different attitudes about the world in terms of ownership. On the founders and executive side, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, we're putting up the money. This is, quote, my idea. And so I should make a lot of money from it. Like, that's the point. That's why I'm doing it. I'm doing it so I can be, you know, very wealthy. And then on the worker side of it, a lot of tech workers, as, you know, many people have claimed, they sort of lean more to the left, the more progressive. You know, you have a lot of LGBTQ+ people in tech. You know, there's a tradition, I think, among tech workers that, like, it is, you know, they want it to be more democratic. They want to have more say in how the thing is operated. But the way venture capital and all that stuff works is just not set up to be that way. I think it should be. Now, again, I'm not saying all tech companies, all companies everywhere should be co-ops, because we can get into why that probably is not the best option either. But I think for a startup or a small tech company, I think it is a very good model, because in those early days, like, I don't think it's a good thing for it. And it's very rare for one person to, quote, come up with the idea that defines a whole tech company. A lot of people have taken credit for things they didn't invent and all that. There's usually the person who figures out how to monetize it ends up becoming the quote founder. So anyway, I'm rambling a bit, but the point is, that's why I think worker co-ops are a great model for tech. You know, everybody should benefit, especially from an early stage company. So, and have a say in how it's operated. So the opportunities and challenges for tech landscape, forming, operating cooperatives, all that stuff. I think, Ethan, you have, you know, out of all this, the most experience with sort of, you know, different acquiring co-ops, different, basically more co-ops. Mine is mostly reading, studying, talking to people, being a co-founder of Limeleaf. But I wanted your perspective on just what you see out there, what kind of co-ops you, that Oberon looks at for, you know, bringing into the fold, all that.
Well, to start with, I would, a clarification for Oberon, we actually don't buy co-ops. We buy founder-led, you know, often founder-owned businesses. And, you know, in essence, it's a form of conversion for us. So we are taking businesses that are not owned by their workers, and by acquiring them into the conglomerate, they're owned. And the way that we're structured is that the all the workers of all the companies own the portfolio together, right? So it's not that you have, you know, that each workplace has direct ownership or, you know, control over their company individually, but they all work together. And then, you know, in conglomerate structure, you also get to share, you know, share profits and share, you know, we have a shared services hub. And so some of those advantages accrue. And that's part of the benefit of that strategy is the transition for the companies we acquire is a bit less pronounced, right? So that when folks are coming in for a number of years, most management structures can remain intact and doesn't change a whole lot. But the fundamental change, I think, to get to you, you know, your point, John, is the governance does fundamentally change, right? At the end of the day, all those companies are owned by a cooperative that is managed by a board that is elected by the members, and the members are the workers. We've recently updated some of our governance structure so that we have then subsidiary boards. So each of our subsidiaries have boards, and the boards have a combination of representation from the cooperative as well as from the workplace. And so kind of balances those two interests. As far as what we're looking for within that space then, and what we've seen is definitely there are aligned founders who are interested in making sure that, you know, their workers are taken care of post-acquisition, which is not something you can take for granted when you're selling a company. That they have maybe thought about worker ownership throughout the course of their, you know, their work and didn't know quite how to do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this offers them opportunity to do that within a structure that's a little more familiar, that gets them some returns. And ideally, if there's some degree of, whether it's horizontal or teal or team management, you know, if there's some awareness within the structure of these principles, that leads to kind of more successful outcomes in the shorter term. But then we have also, you know, we can do that work long term as well. So that's kind of our.
And do you generally have people go out and find companies, or do companies come to you? Like, how does the conversation start for that process?
Yeah, I mean, we have a corporate development practice. So we're reviewing lists, and we got, you know, portfolios of thousands of companies that we're reviewing, going through kind of a buy box. And then we also have some partners. We've worked with the Healthcare Anchor Network and the Kaiser system in California, who's interested in, you know, for them, they see this as a resilience question for their vendors, and so they're interested in looking at how they can move more of their vendors into worker ownership for stability and these pieces. And so they've partnered with us to help us both get a pipeline and make some of those deals happen.
Cool. are there tech startups in the portfolio of companies you're looking at, or have you brought any in recently? Or
yeah, definitely. So we're one place we've been looking at is media and marketing, and so we have some companies there that we're interested in, and that kind of works. We're structured in terms of business sector groups, so we're looking at creating a media group that would be a portfolio for that.
Cool. Steve, I wanted to get your perspective on, we talked a little bit about this in the getting ready for the show, like someone who is relatively new to working at a co-op, if not knowing about them, and what that experience has been like for you and how it has contrasted to the other tech jobs you've had. And then also, just because you're in New York, which is a bit of a, like, at least in terms of the United States, there's a lot of co-op activity in New York, and just kind of what you're seeing among people you meet, run into it, just out and about, and what's happening on the ground there as far as tech.
Yeah, for sure. I'd say the biggest thing to call out is that there's more awareness, I think, of cooperatives and worker cooperatives, just like I saw around 2018, where there was like a shift where tech workers had never even considered unionizing to now it was in their vocabulary. I feel like it's becoming more in more tech spaces that I'm in, which, to be fair, I'm mostly in left-leaning progressive tech spaces, so it's not maybe a completely a representative group, but I'm seeing more co-op channels pop up in chat rooms, in like Slack and in different places, and I'm part of a few different regular calls that happen, some monthly, some bi-monthly, in different networks where people want to talk about co-ops and either forming co-ops or joining co-ops. So I'm definitely seeing more attention being paid to it. I'm not super plugged into the New York City co-op scene at the moment because my co-op is not based in New York, and so we didn't join the local network, but I am planning on joining it separately and then getting more involved. But there's quite a few, like the local one here is New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives. And I think it's pretty large and growing. And then there's a few other groups that I'm forgetting the name and what the acronyms stand for at the moment, but there's even more than one like cooperative group going on right now. There's also here in New York a few different community land trust orgs that are trying to buy up property and have it managed locally by the residents and the tenants. And that's like a newer thing that's picking up steam. I think in general, cooperative ventures are becoming more common. For me, I've been thinking about co-ops for a long time, and it kind of aligns with the way I've always wanted to do things. So even when I was working, I always tried to voice my opinion as much as possible on my team. For a short time, I managed a tech team, and I don't think I was treated super hierarchically. I would make final decisions, but I tried to include everybody all the time in as many decisions as possible. I didn't see that in the wider tech companies. So it's been really nice being part of Interstitial, where all decisions are made, through consensus and through conversation. We use Discourse Forum, where we have conversations and we have some signal groups. Decisions don't always happen quickly in our co-op or in any co-op space, but I don't think that's a bad thing or a problem. I kind of like that it pushes back on this narrative of speed is important and speed equals productivity and efficiency. It will take longer to get to a decision, but it will hopefully be a better decision that everyone's happy with. And I've always, that's one of the critique I've always had of the tech companies I've been at, where they make quick, rash decisions that drastically affect the directory of the company, because they have to, you have to act fast or someone else is going to come in and take over. And I've just always felt that that was kind of a silly thinking. I don't think the world pivots on, like, you know, if we don't if we don't make a decision in the next day, we're gonna go out of business. Like, it's not like that. These things happen slowly over long periods of time, and I've seen so many bad decisions made by management because they thought they had to make a decision quickly. I think we're probably seeing a lot of that with the AI adoption before they fully know how to even use it or implement it. Like, they just or have a fear.
Well, the other virtue is that you have, you know, in a worker co-op, you have everybody involved in building, if it's a product, you know. And this is what a lot of tech companies I've worked at is they keep saying how much they want everyone's input, and they really, you know, varying degrees, I think they do. But when it comes down to it and they're in a board meeting and the board is like, what's the decision? Or whereas, you know, in a worker co-op, everybody is contributing, like you're saying, to the conversation of like, okay, what are we deciding here? What's important? I, you know, have this expertise here because I'm the one who designed the user interface, whatever. You have everybody actually contributing their expertise to the decision. Yeah, it can take a bit longer, but I've also worked at places where there was some decision paralysis because the people in charge of making the decision didn't have really the expertise or all the information to make. I don't know. I think the more people contributing to a decision, even if, I agree, if it's a bit slower, you're going to get the better.
It can be slower and it can be frustrating when you have an idea that you think is a good idea and it doesn't immediately get approval from everyone. It can feel frustrating, but I also think that we need to be more comfortable with that outside of work and in life. And so I think the practice that we're doing in our workspace of coming to decisions collectively and consensually is something that we should also be doing in larger society more often. And so I see this as practice and good. Yeah, good. Things don't have to move fast quickly. I've worked at companies that have definitely said we want everyone to contribute. I've been part of community resource groups in companies where you basically do unpaid labor for the company to give them the impression of like caring about the environment or marginalized groups. Or I was in the accessibility group, and then trying to get them to actually do something that you recommend doing, it's like pulling teeth. They just won't do it. And like you said, ultimately the decision comes down to the board and the leadership. And so, I just really strongly felt like they just wanted to give us the impression that we were contributing so that we would feel more motivated to work.
You actually,
when at the end of the day, they were going to do what they wanted to do.
You bring up a good point too, because all of that stuff that you are bringing up is like supposed to be the stuff that's good for the users and the rest of humanity. But at the end of the day, in those companies, like, that's not what's monetizable ever, right? You could have the most accessible product on the planet, but like, if that only upticks the user count by 5%, like, nobody's going to care. Right. So I think that's sort of why we see a lot of folks, you know, on the progressive side starting in this like movement. Because they're all like inherently ethical, moral, you know, whatever kind of people that you want to, you know, call them. Like, it just tends to, that overlap in that Venn diagram almost is a circle at this point.
I want to say a little difference.
I was just going to also add that while all decisions are made through consensus and through collective discussion, that doesn't mean literally every single decision at every single point in the day is made with input from everyone, which I think often folks think is the case. And then
the whole company doesn't have to vote on your pull request.
Exactly. And so, and if you, I don't know if you want to talk about like the sociocracy model, which gives even more, power to individual groups and circles to make decisions. I think there's a lot of different models. So in my co-op, we also have a board of directors, which is elected yearly by the members from the members. So you're not going to have an investor be on the board, and they're not going to be on there for 4 years. And really, they're mostly there so that they can sign checks and sign bills, but they can make decisions on stuff.
So just to interrupt for 1 second, how many members are there in Interstitial?
We have, I'd say, about a dozen or so, and right now probably about 6 or 7 very active members.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Right, I just wanted to get some context there. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to just add that last bit about not everyone making all decisions, and we do have some structure around. It's not just like a free for all of everyone just yelling ideas. We have a board, and they have some responsibilities that they've committed to over the years, over the year, and then we can assign other committees and stuff that any members can be part of, and still generally everything happens out in the open.
Cool. Go ahead, Ethan.
A few things I wanted to add to the conversation here. I mean, one thing just as a point of data that I think really lines up with all this is I was part of a consensus-led pay scale definition process for like an international team, which took 2 years. You know, if you think about it, if there's work I'm proud of in my career, it's one of the things I'm probably most proud of, because it's really hard to get folks who are in such different, you know, social positions, economic positions, all these things, you know, power positions within the organization, to then come to consensus about how we're going to do pay. It's really hard. And just first to own it, but then to say the outcome of that is that that team wound up being stable for like a decade after that, right? So that work was arduous. It was, there was fractious. There was, real emotions came up. We're talking dealing with real, how do you evaluate cost of living when some folks need to save because there's no social safety net around health in their country? Like, how do you even approach that question, right? So, but if you can get through it, get to the period where people actually understand each other's opinions and perspectives and come to a collective solution, I think you really do see real benefits around resilience, connection, stability, team cohesion. Like, it really does, it does something really, it's pretty magical and pretty amazing. That said, I think it's also worth noting that co-ops don't need to be governed this way. I mean, don't need to operate this way, right? Like, a co-op can choose to be purely hierarchical if that's what the members think is in their best interest for the company being successful. That is in the members' rights to say, you know what, we're gonna have a single point of responsibility. They can organize in terms of DRIs, so directly responsible individuals who, for within a domain, they have the authority and the responsibility to make certain decisions, and everyone's expecting them to do that. And they're accountable to the group. So the dynamics are still different than a purely capital-led or purely founder-led situation. But and one anti-pattern that we sometimes joke about is sort of like the 5-year-old soccer team decision style, where like everyone sort of swarms every decision. and I think it is really helpful to have a structure.
Yep.
To know what your decision-making approach is, to be able to point to something and say, no, we do this, and that's what we're doing right now, and maybe this is going to be advice process, and this is going to be, different. I also point to Liberating Structures. The website is a great source for different processes around that. One thing I would look out for is kind of an undefined kind of group decisioning by default. Have some structure, but then and commit to it, and that can really be of the group's.
You bring up a good point on like the pay stuff too, because one of the things that I had to sort of wrap my head around and sort of look at a little bit differently is pay. And maybe Steve, maybe you can attest to this too. Like, working in some of the bigger tech companies or the startups, the traditional VC led model of a company, like, in order to get talent is like you're gonna pay through the roof, maybe not now, but like in the AI age, but like 5-10 plus years ago, like, people were paying through the roof for talent. Given the model of a co-op, like, is that possible if the revenue is coming in, but like in the first couple of years, is it going to be that way? Probably not. You're just not going to have that income. So like a big topic around like even starting your own co-op is like realistically like pay for tech workers that are used to being paid very well and then having to make that choice to switch is a very real decision that folks have to look at, you know, when they make this move.
Yeah, I think I that's one thing that came to mind as I was thinking about this topic. One thing I think is also surprising to folks who get into cooperatives sometimes is you look at like maybe a standard VC backed success story where there's maybe, you know, $100 million in final equity distribution or something, you know, at the end, and you're like, great, I'm going to start a co-op with 10 people. We're going to split that between the 10 of us and it's going to be amazing. And that can be really hard when, you know, because first of all, the first years of any business are not those years. Right. And second of all, I think what you often find is when you have the agency to control your own employment, you know, organization, you might choose to prioritize other things over that mega cash out, right? You might choose to prioritize livable wage for all of your workers. You might choose to prioritize saner schedules and saying, you know, there's other things you choose, and the compensation for being part of a cooperative doesn't always show up directly as massive profit distribution. Or equity, though I think it does have advantages as far as structuring your kind of equity. You know, your tables can be simpler, and there's more trust there about if you do choose to start something as a co-op and then sell it. There's advantages there, but it can be surprising to folks sometimes that it doesn't math out the way they might have expected when they were looking at it from the outside.
Yeah, and that touches on something that I wanted to talk about is financing. So this is one of the things that I think is very different with a co-ops, at least today. I hope it changes, but if you're, you know, a few people and you're starting a tech co-op and you go to some VC fund, first of all, they're not even going to want to talk to you. But so it is a challenge. Like how do you, like, let's say a product focused tech co-op, services is a little bit different. How, and Ethan, this probably maybe a more question for you because you've probably done this, like getting the seed money to start it and for the first year of operations and all these things, what are the options for a worker co-op in tech to do that?
I think I can speak to the two scenarios I'm familiar with.
Yep.
You know, I think, Steve, you could probably talk more to this immediately, but there is a sort of collective model, right, which is often like a bootstrapped, whether that's a product or a services business. And those tend to be low upfront capital investment. You can, you know, you can basically bootstrap that through a lot of sweat equity and putting, you know, putting your time in to make it work. And then in the space of acquisitions, which is what Oberon focuses on, mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit of a different scenario because we're able to, you know, we have EBITDA, we have all of the stats to say this is the value of this business, and so that can then be used to engage senior debt. You can get bank lenders to be part of that stack, and then there is an ecosystem, right, of folks who do support the worker ownership space and do help invest in these projects. So that's groups like Project Equity. It's groups like the Start Co-op folks and the working, you know, the workers world. All these things, right? So I think, you know, there's, and those tend to be smaller dollar amounts, but they can also be great if you have a, an idea. Like there are definitely like 100K prizes you can get, you know, grants you can get that will help you bootstrap cooperatives, but, you know, in specific sectors.
Yeah. We're seeing most of those coming out of Europe right now. Because there's a big movement over there for, you know, tech sovereignty and getting away from using exclusively US-based tech products. And kind of, for whatever reason, you know, there are a number of reasons that they have, but like there's a fund in the Netherlands. There's just a lot of, there's even a whole EU initiative. And I'm part of a group, well, we are as Limeleaf, part of a group called Patio, which is mostly based in Europe. Steve, I think you're in there as well. And they're trying to, you know, win some contracts from these initiatives to like, okay, we don't want to use Google Workspace. What do we do? Who wants to build that? And then, there's another good friends of ours over at Comp.co-op. They're getting some financing right now through a loan. So there are different ways to do it. It's just, I think, one expectation that people should have, and this might be a good segue into, like, okay, great, I want to start a co-op. What do I do? If your goal is to become a billionaire, that co-op, a worker co-op, is not your scene. It's just not going to happen by its very design. Like, unless you, I don't know, maybe if you have a 10-member co-op and you come up with an AI thing that someone wants to acquire, $50 billion, okay, yeah. But and you can absolutely do that. The other misconception, I think, about co-ops is it's like, well, it's hippies doing, like, grocery stores and stuff. It's like, it does not have to. You can be a, you know, very ambitious person who wants to be rich. Maybe you're not going to completely fit in with co-op people, but those people are definitely out there. And if you want to do it as a co-op, you can absolutely do that. But if you want to have, you know, if you want to be a part of a organization that you make a living, you have a say in what goes on. And again, Ethan, to your point, in your operating agreement, if you want to structure it in such a way that there's layoff protection. So every month we set aside a certain amount of money in a fund. And if things go south and the economy sours, we're all going to maybe not pay ourselves 100% of what we usually make, but we're going to, you know, there's that side of it as well, especially with all the layoffs happening and people starting to realize, like, wow, in 2022, when everyone was kissing my ass and trying to hire me, and, you know, now I'm being flushed out and I can't, like, I've no people that this is happening. Like, send out 50 resumes, apply to whatever, and get literally zero people calling you back. A major shift. So, okay, anyway, starting a co-op. So what I keep telling people is, like, if you've been laid off for more than, say, 3 months and you're not having a lot of success getting callbacks on interviews or whatever, and you know three other people who are in the same situation, you might want to start talking about starting a co-op. Because, you know, if you don't have a lot of options and you want to take some degree of control over your own future, just do it. Like, it doesn't cost much. You know, you create a, and again, this varies by state, like what the entity looks like and all those things. And we'll put some resources for doing this in the show notes, but just in general, Steve and Ethan, I just wanted you guys to kind of talk about, like, if you were starting a tech co-op and you we're trying to advise people, like, I have this idea or I wanted to start doing these services, where do I start, how do I get this ball rolling? I don't know if you want to start with Steve, you want to go first?
Yeah, I would say the first thing you need is other people to do it with. That is the most important thing, because you can start your own business. But if you're trying to do this a cooperative business, you need cooperators, you need other people. And I was talking in preparation for this call, I was talking to some members of Interstitial, and we agreed one of the hardest parts of getting a co-op off the ground is finding other people that you trust a lot, because being in a co-op with other people is a high trust situation. You can work with an asshole. You can be in a traditional company and the guy at the other desk is a jerk who you never want to talk to, and he just pumps out code, and that's great. You never have to talk to him and make a decision together. But you wouldn't be able to work with that guy and come to consensus about different things. So I think the most important thing is finding other people who you want to do it with. And then the next thing, yeah, like you said, money can definitely be an issue. I think that's why so many tech co-ops are similar, are usually, like, dev shops, are usually contract and freelance based. It's just easy because there's no overhead. You don't need an investment of a ton of money to buy equipment and start manufacturing stuff. What you do need, though, is a runway of cash saved up, because you're probably not going to start making a lot of money. So I think that's also another unfortunate thing, just because you might not be making a lot of money for the first year or two,
right?
While you build a user base, there are ways to get money. Like you mentioned, you can, if you're building an open source tool, you can apply for a grant. Someone in our co-op applied for a grant for a cool open source note tool that he's been working on. I also want to give a shout out. You mentioned a couple of groups earlier. I just want to also give a shout out to Seed Commons, which is a network of investor funds for co-ops and other democratic workplaces. And a lot of local networks. So if you want to start, if you're in New York City and you want to start a co-op, talk to the New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives. They have workshops and resources where they will help you get off the ground. They will point you to the right lawyers and people. Similarly, if you don't have a local, if you're out in the Bay Area, there's NoBawc, NoBawc. If you're in a city that doesn't have a local cooperative network, there's always the United States Federation of Worker Cooperatives. They have an open Slack, so anybody can join their Slack workspace. You don't have to be in a co-op. You can just be interested in co-ops. And they have we interstitial is member pay, dues paying member of that, but you don't have to be a dues paying member to access the vast majority of their resources, and they have lots of resources on forming a co-op. So I would recommend, after you find people you want to do it with, figure out your finances and what your runway is, talk to a local or larger network of co-ops for advice.
Go ahead, Ethan.
Yeah, I think basically everything Steve says, and I definitely want to pick up the Seed Commons and the U.S. Federation are wonderful resources. They also have mentor and coach programs that you can get. So if you want someone to actually really see you through that process, in turn, the first advice, if you're thinking about starting a worker co-op, is do it. I think it's one of those things where it's like, you're never going to quite be ready. You're never going to know enough about how to do it. Learn it by doing. I think almost anyone who's gotten into it, do some studying. But the best thing to do is just to do it. And because it's such a aligned, supportive community, I think the resources are really there to steward folks through it. And so that's the number one thing I would say. I'd say, find a local conference, find a local group that you can get connected with, and call up folks in existing co-ops that, that maybe are similar to yours, do the kind of information landscape analysis stuff.
Yeah.
Folks really willing to share their knowledge and their perspective. There's also launch.coop. There's things like the new economy MBA program out of Lyft Economy is really great. Dowie is also institute.coop is a great resource as well. Another thing, if you're in New York City, CUNY runs some great courses on cooperatives and starting cooperatives. There's really a lot of resources. And the other thing I would add, is I think there are opportunities around novel combinations of some of the ESOP employee ownership structures and cooperatives to think about, especially if you maybe are somewhat more, if you're thinking more of a conversion or more of something that's a little more capital intensive, thinking about employee ownership there. I wouldn't rule out thinking about how can you get some of the tax advantages and some of the benefits of having an ESOP financial structure with a cooperative governance and management structure, kind of the what people are calling the ESOPerative model. I think there's a lot to be gained there, and that might involve talking to a lawyer and getting some ideas. I think launch.coop is a great way to steer people towards some of those resources as well.
Yeah, we'll put all these again in the show notes. Go ahead, Steve.
I just want to give one more shout out to another New York City group that the name has slipped my mind earlier when I was naming it. So New York City Network of Worker Cooperatives is great. Another one here locally is the CEA NYC, Cooperative Economics Alliance of New York City. And they do more than just worker cooperatives. So if you want to start a community garden or a food co-op or a housing co-op, they do all sorts of cooperative economic projects. So that's another group that I follow and I would highly recommend reaching out to if you're anywhere in the New York area. Or honestly, even if you're not in New York City, the nature of cooperative right. supporting groups is that you could reach out to a co-op network in Seattle and you live in Wyoming, like Florida. Yeah,
that's one of the biggest things that we've seen when we were starting off initially. Even now, like we have like a bi-weekly call with Compta co-op. Like arguably we're kind of sort of in the same professional services business. You know, if they don't have the skill set to do a project that they talk to a potential partner for, you know, we could call them up and say like, hey, you want to work together on this? It's like, or no, that's not really our bag. Like, you know, might want to go talk to that co-op out of Seattle and, you know, co-develop on that for that project. So like the amount of project sharing amongst different co-ops and different disciplines is like common all over the place, which is a really nice thing.
Yeah, it's very rare to come across a jerk, to be honest. I mean, most people you're going to come across in the co-op world are just good people. They just are. I mean, I know that sounds biased and everything else, but like I've yet to, and I've been in other situations where I've dealt with a lot of very difficult people who were not into cooperating. And usually if someone is dedicated to cooperating in any respect, then, you know, they're just going to be a better person. So as we start to close out here, I wanted to just give you guys an opportunity for, you know, last thoughts or if, you know, any advice to someone who's starting a co-op, like mistakes to avoid that, you know, anything glaring that you can think of. And then we'll get into the takeaways. I can edit out anything if you want to just think about it for a minute as well. You know, we're already at like 50 some minutes, but usually about 5 minutes of the show gets edited out because of, you know, transitions and stuff.
I could say a few words.
Okay.
So one thing I also wanted to add was another huge benefit of the worker cooperative model. We mentioned that you have control over the decisions you make. I just wanted to talk more specifically about what that means. It means that if you've worked at a company that takes defense contracts or takes contracts with, you know, public figures who you maybe disagree with and espouse politics that are offensive and hurtful to members of the your workers, and you've had nothing you can do about it, maybe you go to a town hall and then they ignore you. Or like my company, they slowly phased out town halls because they were getting too contentious. At a worker cooperative, you get to choose what work you do, and you get to choose who you work with. It's all about cooperation and free association. No one's going to force you to take a contract with Amazon if you don't want to support Amazon. We do, in Interstitial, we do a lot of open source. We're very big on open source and small tech projects. And we also love working with other co-ops. So I'm starting this week a work project with a food cooperative out in California. Cool. And we're starting hopefully later this month another project with a cooperative. But you have that control over what the work is that you do. And so I think that's really important and special. In terms of mistakes you can make, I'd say someone brought up earlier, I think it was you, John, about having some sort of structure and rules that everyone agrees on so that when there is sort of friction or whatever, you can point to, well, this is what we agreed on, like, let's move forward there. I think thinking seriously about how to deal with conflict and what to do when things go wrong is important to do up front. I've seen co-ops that have fractured and just fallen apart because of conflict.
Yep.
And I'm kind of a proponent of if half your members want to do one thing and half want to do another thing, maybe it's time to split up into two co-ops. There's no reason to fight over the branding and the name and all it. Like, think about it ahead of time. Think about it ahead of time. What happens if we can't agree on a direction? How do we amicably split up and keep the cooperative model going? So I think thinking ahead on that, having some processes in place for what do you do if a worker member is not cooperating with people, if they are causing trouble in the co-op, if they're not contributing, how do you remove a member of the co-op, because just as co-op should be as open as possible and inviting, you need to protect yourselves and your space. And so you need a process for removing people if they no longer are fit in the co-op. So yeah, I think it's just important to think about all that stuff up front. I don't think that's a reason not to do what I think Ethan recommended, just go for it and do it. Mm-hmm. Totally agree with that. But then once you start it, after a few weeks or a few months, like, sit down and think about long term, how are we going to deal with conflict in the future?
Yeah, that's great advice. Ethan.
Steve just that was mine. That was my big thing I was going to say as well. I think accountability is really hard in a co-op setting, just to be honest. And one way that I think is a positive way to see that is a lot of what we're doing in cooperatives is we're de-alienating ourselves. We're becoming more human in relationship to our coworkers and our collaborators. And that's wonderful when it feels good, and it's really hard when it feels bad, in the sense that we can't we don't have the sort of like anonymizing, numbing layer of kind of just kind of financial relation to hide behind, and so it makes some of the difficult conversations harder sometimes.
Yep.
And it's again, I think, an anti-pattern of, you know, kind of watching out for patterns of avoidance, of not having the hard conversations, watching out for patterns of allowing any kind of misbehavior is another thing to really watch out for. So I think the positive one there is have a code of conduct. Know for your community, for your group, what's in bounds and what's out of bounds. And have some way of addressing when it goes out of bounds, and know in advance that it might be difficult, but and another piece there is practice having those hard conversations. Look for the little times that you have the opportunity to have a difficult conversation and take advantage of that. See it as an opportunity. You know, hey, I've noticed you haven't been available for the last half hour of your day, even though we agreed to have a work day till, you know, this time, you know,
right.
You know, why is that? That's a great opportunity to do that stuff. And then, let's see, as far as, well, so the prompt was thing, you know, things to watch out for. So I think the sort of piece there, things that I'm excited about right now, just two more things I'd like to plug in there. One, I think, you know, a lot of states now also have the public benefit corporation statutes that are becoming more formal. Are you all a PBC?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, interstitial is the PBC.
You know, there's lots of groups who are coming out, and I think that's a really great mechanism. You know, in Canada, they have this kind of nonprofit cooperative structure, which is really, I think, would align a lot with a lot of folks who start co-ops in the U.S.'s goals, but we don't have it here. But I think the PBC co-op seems to be something that offers more.
Allbirds is a PBC, so there's evidence that you get really rich. Their stock is up. They said they're becoming an AI company, and their stock is up 900%. So there's
actually the one thing I wanted to make, just one note, just to speak to AI for a second, around... I think that there are advantages for the sort of, especially the collectivist sort of model of co-ops for AI, and that there's a lot less, you know, a lot of the gatekeepers and a lot of the blockings as far as like, how do I get the expertise to run my own business and all the different functions that management expertise and other structures will provide. I do think that we're at this little, you know, point right now where suddenly you can get all this, you know, advice and guidance and how to do your own legal stuff and how to do your own bookkeeping stuff. And, you know, it's not, you know, and everyone knows it's not really the same as an expert, but you can defray a lot of the cost, and that's wonderful. And I think an opportunity for cooperatives here, as this sort of like the individual actor is maybe more empowered. So a model that empowers individual actors is going to maybe see some benefit there. The caution I would say there is just be up on a lot of the analysis coming out right now about the degree to which the current AI landscape is being subsidized, and the fact that the price model is likely to change very drastically in the coming months. So great opportunity, maybe take it while you can. but have your eyes open about where this is likely going, and don't make it essential to your business case, your business model right now.
I agree 100%. Everybody who knows me, including the two people on this call who are sick of hearing me talk about this shit is not free. Anthropic spends $13 for every dollar of revenue they bring in. Someone's going to have to pay that bill at some point. So, and again, I'm not like totally like, there are definitely going to be some benefits that come out of AI. Cory Doctorow has an interesting perspective on this. He's like, after the crash, there's going to be so much hardware and resources out there to do ethical AI. But I think that's kind of what he's hoping for. But
I think there's definitely going to be room for buyers co-ops, of call, you know, for folks who want to use, so, you know, secondhand, you know, kind of AI there equipment to have, you know, to have ethical, you know, AI infrastructure for businesses that are all aligned around worker power is probably.
Yeah. Blaine and Mubs, I don't know if you guys any.
No, I think we covered a lot of stuff, but not for me.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mubs.
Okay.
Yeah, I did have one though, and I think it came up in the conversation a few times, and I just wanted to kind of put a little bit of emphasis on it here, I guess. But I think it's okay. Co-ops are not for everybody, right? Like, some people just want to show up, they want to work from 9 to 5, they want to go home, and they want to do their own thing, and that's absolutely fine for a lot of people. But co-ops, you know, you actually have to take responsibility. You have to take ownership of not just the co-op, but the responsibility of making choices, of educating yourself so you can make those choices as well. I think that's the other important bit. Like, if you're going to start a co-op, like, do you really want to own the place that you work at? And I think for a lot of people, the sort of answer is no. And for a lot of people, the answer is yes.
Yep.
And I think as people, we just kind of have to make that conscious choice about, like, what kind of employment do I want? Do I want somewhere where I just show up? Or do I want somewhere where I actually participate, where I take responsibility? And as a collective, we kind of make the sort of right choice for everybody, as opposed to just having the choices pushed kind of onto you, but you're okay with that because you just want to show up to your work and leave. And I think, yeah, that to me was always a sort of first step, because I've been around for a while now, and you can tell the people sort of in the office that, like, okay, these people actually want to be involved. They want to be, they want to make the choices. And some people just like, you know, some people are just like, just tell me what to do, I will do it, and then I'll leave. That's okay as well. Yep. But yeah, so I think that was the other thing. It kind of, like I said, it kind of came up a few times in the conversation. But I think it's an important distinction to kind of make. Are you the kind of person who wants to be at a co-op? It sounds cool, right? Like, kind of, I'm kind of involved. I want to make choices. I want to help push things in the right direction. But are you really going to do the work that's required to make that happen?
Great point.
So, just a little counterpoint there, Mubs, because I agree, and I think it's wonderful. And I also think there's room in a lot of co-ops for folks who just want to show up and who might benefit from, like, I've had some wonderful collaborators who have been in this kind of profile of, I've worked at a bunch of companies. I like you all. You all are a little chiller. The decisions are made are a little bit better. I'm not going to be part of it, all the decision-making process. You can take that. Liquid democracy is also saying that we could be thinking about more in terms of cooperatives. Like, how do you just, like, maybe just doing flexible delegation? And some folks maybe are going to delegate a lot of their decision-making about most things. Like, unless it's about pay or hours worked, I don't care. So you can make all those decisions, and I care about this domain.
What's that?
So I think it's kind of a both and, right. But I think it's definitely, when they get a little larger, and established, I think it's good. You know, I think there's it's important there for there to be room for different levels of
involvement. And that's the other thing I was going to say is, like, that's the other thing that I've seen over time as well, is at the, you know, as you work at sort of larger, more kind of capitalistic driven companies, information becomes a power resource and it becomes part of the power dynamic. And so just like the sort of learning opportunities you get can be a lot more limited in like a normal company versus in a co-op, it's kind of incumbent on everybody else to educate everybody about how things work, about what the choices that you need to make, and all the information that needs to make those choices. I've been fortunate. I guess I worked a lot of early stage companies where we kind of all had to wear a lot of hats, and so you got exposed to a lot of different things, and you had to learn those things. You kind of had to make choices. But I've also seen the other side of it, where I worked at extremely large companies, where it's like you do your little sliver of kind of what's needed, and you don't really know what else is out there, and people aren't really incentivized to kind of educate you on those other things as well. And so that's the other advantage of a sort of co-op. If you really do want to run your own business one day, or if you want to run your own co-op, or start your own co-op one day, joining an existing one can get you experience and input that you wouldn't normally get kind of elsewhere as well.
All right. Well, I think as we wrap up, what I would like to just, talk to the people out there who are feeling frustrated. If you've lost your job, if you're, laid off and can't get any traction with anything, to Ethan's point, start something. Maybe it's not going to be your full-time job in 3 years, but if it's something that you can do with a few other people, the worst thing about being out of work is feeling like you're just, what am I? I'm by myself. I got nobody to help me out here or give me any support. So even if you team up with three other people as a part-time co-op, just doing 10 hours a week or something, in other words, it doesn't have to be, a full-time, we're going to dedicate 10 years to this. It's just something that you can work on with a few other people to earn some extra money, or just have the support of a few other people who are in the same position as you. And it's not hard to start one. There are resources. I shout out to the Swire Center at the University of Albany Law School. They gave us literally free, our entire co-op was set up with free legal help from a wonderful lawyer over at the Swire Center. So there are resources like that out there. Feel free to hit up me. I'm John at LimeLeaf.coop. There'll be resources in the show notes for this show. There's all kinds of helpful people out there. A lot of the like Patio and USFWC Slack, things that that we mentioned in the episode, a lot of them don't really, yes, there's a membership level, but as an individual person, a lot of them are kind of open groups where you can just sort of join and start talking to people. And then on the other side of it, if you're a rich person out there, I think we need, especially for product-oriented tech co-ops, we need better financing operations or alternatives. And I've had this conversation with people at like the New York State co-op meetup last fall, where I met Ethan. There's got to be a model that is some kind of hybrid of investor class shares, or there's got to be some way that we can finance co-ops that is not the traditional private equity or venture capital or the things that are kind of diametrically opposed to the way co-ops work and the world that we want to build. There has to be some other way to finance these things that investors can get some kind of return. Again, not going to become billionaires, but it's an investment in society, not just an investment in some company that's going to make you rich. If that's important to you, start putting your money out there.
Yeah, we need PBIs, public benefit investors.
Yeah.
Yes, there you go.
Transform Finance is a great resource for folks who are interested in involving in alternative ownership structures. They have a great. I'll share it with you all as well.
Ooh, yeah, no,
database of a few hundred or so funds that are currently operating in the space, and some great learning resources for investors who are interested in doing that. Because, and again, Project Equity also there's a lot of folks who are doing some really interesting work thinking about that.
All right, well, that's the episode. Thank you everyone for listening. We are limeleaf.coop on the web, and I'll have links to Steve and Ethan's organizations in the show notes. We are building a product called Hen House. It itself will be a cooperative. It's web hosting, affordable, privacy focused, data sovereign. It's basically the server in Europe is all. And thank you guys so much for joining us. I hope this was a good experience for you. It was certainly super helpful.
Thanks, guys.
You guys are both extremely knowledgeable. Yeah, and then we'll be back next month. I don't know yet what next month's episode is. Well, anybody has any ideas or suggestions, send them to info@lineweave.coop or to me.coop. And that's it for this month.
Bye, everybody.
We'll talk to you all next month.
Thanks, all.